Hello, and welcome to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. This week we have a sermon from guest speaker Kent Davis Sensenig.
Jennifer and I spent part of our Christmas in Minnesota, making merry with the Davis side of the family. As a build-up to the upcoming Super Bowl to be played in Minneapolis, marketers have blanketed the city with the dashing slogan, "The Bold North." Felt more like the cold North to me, but... The Christmas gift our 16-year-old niece, Gloria, was most excited to share with us was her brand new collection of essential oils. I learned these oils can rejuvenate hair and skin, or even be diffused into the air as an aromatic mist. When Jennifer wondered how they might help her complexion, Gloria professionally replied, "First, I need to know what your facial concerns are." In the mix of Gloria's helpful facial prescription was a healthy dose of frankincense, which brings us to Matthew chapter 2 and our featured scripture for Epiphany Sunday, which was very excellently delivered. I can't top that scripture reading there. That was awesome. Matthew's account of the three wise men, or three kings, or three magi from the east is a familiar one for many of us, even though we often conflate it with Luke's earthy shepherds, heavenly angels, and barnyard animals version of Jesus' birth, and even though the text never actually says there are three men, only that there are three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. While Jesus admittedly made quite a haul that first Christmas morning, it was not the three gifts that drew my attention this time around. Taking a Lectio Divina approach, where you listen for words that attract you, three phrases jumped out at me. The first was, "in the time of King Herod." The second is, "they left for their own country by another road." And finally, "they made a home in a town called Nazareth." The opening words of our scripture, "in the time of King Herod," immediately bring concerns of chronology to mind. Where are we in history? This question seems especially appropriate as we turn the page on another year, on this first Sunday worshiping together in 2018. It is a testament to the fact that Jesus is the most important figure in human history that today Jesus' birth is the pivot point by which the whole world measures time. It is now more than 2,000 years since Jesus first burst on the scene, and he's never left. But we no longer live in the time of Herod. It's now the time of Trump. We are always tempted to get overly entangled in our particular moment in time. No doubt this is inevitable, even necessary. As Dickens famously said of the French Revolution, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." Perhaps we can rightly believe each in turn about our own epoch. But before Trump tweets entirely fill our horizon of consciousness, I thought it might be edifying to steal a page from EMU's centennial exercises last year and again look back 100 years, this time to 1918, and see what was happening in the world. And that is why I will now ask Louise Hostetter to come forward and organize the rest of my sermon. Just kidding. Jennifer said I'm allowed three jokes in this sermon, and you can make the call on when these jokes arrive or don't. So, along the way of our getting a historical perspective detour, I will first try to sketch some broad comparisons between 1918 and 2018 before asking what it might mean for us to return to our own country by another road. And make a home for ourselves in a town called Harrisonburg. 1918 was the last of four slogging years of brutality, then called the Great War. A violent sequel renamed and seemingly downgraded the Great War to only World War I, the first and lesser of two global catastrophes. The German Kaiser's spring offensive on the Western Front that year left 20,000 British men dead on the field in the first day of battle. Called the war to end all wars, President Wilson argued that the U.S. must enter the fray in 1917 so that the world might be made safe for democracy. When the Great War finally ground to a tortured halt on November 11, 1918, Armistice Day, 10 million soldiers and 7 million civilians had lost their lives, with total casualties estimated at 37 million worldwide. Ominously, 1918 also witnessed the very first American bombing raid, utilizing the still-fledgling technology of airplanes. This diabolical tactic inflicted untold devastation throughout the rest of the century. Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat and the last Virginian in the Oval Office, became the first sitting U.S. president to travel overseas to attend the Paris Peace Conference that negotiated the war settlement. As Johann and Sue's Yard strikingly reminds us, a different kind of peace conference was held recently in Paris, this time to negotiate a settlement between the world's nations and the planet. Wilson's ill-fated League of Nations proposal to create an international body to prevent future conflicts was never ratified by Congress, but laid the foundation for what became the United Nations following the Second World War. The Western world no longer experiences World War I level casualties, but as we enter 2018, the two longest wars in American history, in Iraq and Afghanistan, roll on with no foreseeable end in sight, out of sight, out of mind for most of us. Of course, the war on terrorism, under whose dubious conceptual umbrella both wars were launched, is by definition an endless one. Our current interventions in vicious civil wars in Syria and Yemen are the latest chapters in this unfinished and unfinishable saga. 1918 is perhaps unique in world history in that three major empires came to an end in essentially the same year: the Russian Tsarist, the Turkish Ottoman, and the Austro-Hungarian. And though they didn't yet know it, the carnage of World War I left both the English and French empires with mortal wounds from which they never fully recovered. As Tim Seidel's adult ed class on Israel-Palestine this fall here at CMC highlighted, secret agreements made between England and France during World War I carved up the corpse of the Ottoman Empire with little regard for the ethnic and religious makeup of the diverse peoples of the Mideast. These Western redrawings created the modern map of the region, ultimately birthing the nation states of Israel, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Jordan. Most of these borders are contested to this day, representing one of the root causes of ongoing Middle Eastern conflict. The recent declaration of a potential independent Kurdish state in northern Iraq, where our own Nathan Hershberger and Caitlin Heatwall recently concluded 2 years of service with Mennonite Central Committee, is just the latest wrinkle in this century-old conundrum. Back home in the U.S., Congress passed both the Sedition and Immigration Acts in 1918 in response to America's original Red Scare. These reactionary pieces of legislation were inspired by a triple-headed bogeyman of fears about 1, Bolshevik-influenced labor union agitation. The Russian Revolution had just happened a year before. 2, anarchist terrorism, like the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand of Austria, which had helped ignite the First World War. And 3, a swelling surge of millions of mostly non-English-speaking immigrants transforming America's demographic map, especially from Southern and Eastern Europe, and largely of Catholic, Orthodox, and Jewish religions. That is, not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. The Sedition Act unleashed the notorious Palmer Raids, named for Wilson's Attorney General, which led to the deportation of hundreds of perceived radicals. The Immigration Act oversaw the installation of a racist, pro-Northern European immigration quota system that remained in place until 1965, prolonging the life of a white Protestant-dominated America for an extra half century. Emma Goldman, the famous and feared Russian Jewish labor organizer, was one of those radicals deported for encouraging Americans to resist the military draft promulgated by President Wilson in 1917. Thousands of Peace Church Christians, including many Mennonites, were also harassed and even imprisoned at this time for their conscientious objection to warfare. The Sedition Act made it a crime to disrespect America's flag, government, or military. Thankfully for our own Simon Dula, who took a knee a few weeks back during the playing of the national anthem at his elementary school, this law is no longer enforced. Of course, unlike 1918, today we no longer have problems in this country with fear-based and discriminatory immigration policies or heavy-handed deportations disproportionately affecting those who speak English as a second language, have darker shades of skin, or practice a minority faith. Nor do obstacles stand in the way of today's workers who seek to organize to improve their conditions. It says, insert tongue-in-cheek emoji here. I should have a big one right here. Returning to 1918, this period also saw the 20th century revival of the original Ku Klux Klan, inspired in part by the white supremacist revisionist history of one of America's first major motion pictures, The Birth of a Nation, released in 1915 to great acclaim, including a special White House screening for President Wilson himself. 1915 was the year the new KKK was founded in the South, but its membership surged in white Protestant communities across the Midwest and West in the next decade, reaching its historic zenith. Today, we speak of the rise of the alt-right, as crystallized in this summer's disturbances across the mountain in Charlottesville, and even showing up, as of old, in the White House itself. Major African-American leaders like W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and Marcus Garvey offered distinctive and diverse political strategies to African-Americans at this time in the face of such systemic racism. Just as today, the Black Lives Matter movement is one of many seeking better lives for our country's black and brown folk. In 1918, the suffragist movement to give women the right to vote was shaking the halls of power, finally achieving success in 1920. Perhaps in an analogous way to the quaking caused by the ongoing hashtag MeToo movement on behalf of women's dignity and workplace rights. New twists on old struggles. Finally, 1918 saw the worldwide outbreak of the Spanish flu, leaving an estimated 20 million dead in its wake. In America today, we speak more of a fatal epidemic of opioid abuse, though we hopefully also remember that pandemic diseases continue to plague many parts of the globe, and how the truly new phenomenon of climate change threatens the health and millions of health and security of millions, as seen in last year's extreme weather disasters in Texas, Puerto Rico, California, Florida, and elsewhere all around the globe. I could highlight more historical events from 1918, as seen in this page I cut out of my sermon. This information will be available as a bonus feature on the DVD, however. I want to conclude with the other two, and I believe more important, phrases from Matthew's gospel I highlighted earlier. Given this time of Trump context in which we live, how might we, like the wily, wise ones of old, outfoxing the schemes of Herod, find a way back to our own country by another road? That is, find an alternative way to be Americans that is faithful to Jesus. And secondly, how might we, like the holy family of Joseph, Mary, and Jesus, coming to Nazareth after years living as refugees in Egypt, make a home for ourselves in a town called Harrisonburg? In seeking some directions for a way back to a new home and an old country, I want to leave us with some snapshots from the recently concluded life of Titus Bender, who might be a model of both things for us. A few of you knew Titus well. His memorial service was held right here at CMC a few weeks ago. Like Ted Swartz and hundreds of others, I too was shaped by Titus and Ray Ginrich's classic Peace and Justice course my sophomore year at EMU. Titus had a big heart for the marginal of society, the folks Jesus called the least of these, the little ones, the last, the lost, the lame. He embraced a religious tradition led by a marginal Jew and identified with the tribe of marginal Jesus followers that were his 16th century Anabaptist faith ancestors. The alternative road back to America that Titus and his wife Anna walked led them on an 11-year pilgrimage in Meridian, Mississippi, a place made nationally notorious when one of its hometown boys, an African-American named James Chaney, was one of three college-age civil rights volunteers murdered during the Freedom Summer Drive to register black voters in 1964. The Benders also contributed to Freedom Summer's registration drive, and Titus later helped organize Mennonite disaster service efforts to rebuild some of the 60 to 70 churches that were bombed or burned as part of the White Terror campaign that followed in that summer's wake. The Benders first went to Mississippi in 1958 to direct a Mennonite voluntary service unit, a tradition we at CMC are trying to continue here in Harrisonburg. Titus also pastored the Fellowship Mennonite Church of Meridian during these years, while Anna taught at one of the nation's very first Head Start programs. Both helped start the Pine Lake Fellowship Camp, a gathering place for local blacks, whites, and Choctaw people, and one of the first integrated camps in the South. Titus and Anna were in the vanguard of ethnic Mennonites engaged in the American civil rights struggle, which is another way of saying that not too many other Mennonites did. After a decade of education in Mississippi's School of Hard Knocks, Titus went back to graduate school at Tulane University, earning a doctorate in social work. This segues the Benders into the second major vocational stage of their lives, right here in Harrisonburg. Titus taught social work and peace and justice courses for more than 20 years at EMU, and alongside the likes of our own Ray Ginrich and Rick Yoder, Vernon Jancy, and many others, laid the groundwork for what became the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, one of EMU's first graduate programs. Like down in Mississippi, Titus also engaged deeply in the broader community, helping to found a Big Brothers Big Sisters chapter in Harrisonburg, which CMCers like Rebecca Barge, Carmen Wise, and Tiffany Schulwater have carried forward in recent years. Titus was perhaps proudest of his role in starting Gemeinschaft, the prisoner reentry halfway house perched atop Mount Clinton Pike, just a few hundred yards from EMU. The choice of criminal justice reform as this year's issue for our own ecumenical Faith and Action Coalition, and longer-term efforts by the likes of Ruth Stolzfus Jost, Harvey Yoder, Jason Gerlach, and now Jason Wagner, each in their own turn seeks to amplify this part of Bender's local legacy. And especially in their retirement years, the Benders devoted energies to the emerging Eastern Mennonite Elementary School that their daughter, Maria Archer, directs, and which CMCers like our own Joyce Lind and now Hannah Bailey have helped to flourish over the years. So, what might we learn from the Benders about making a home in Harrisonburg by being alternative-minded Anabaptist Americans? First off, I noticed that, like many of us at CMC, Titus was not originally from Harrisonburg, but came here after years of formative work in another place, as well as to attend EMU in his youth. But even if serving here in the Berg may not have been had quite the adventurous drama and level of cross-cultural challenge as his years in Mississippi, Titus engaged a life of service, peacemaking, and gospel outreach just as passionately here as there. In fact, he ended up spending more than twice as many years here in the Valley as he did in Mississippi. Just as my own parents spent most of their lives responding to Jesus's call in Lancaster County, of all places, after their decade of service in Saigon, South Vietnam. Like the Benders, we too might have come here for school or after years of significant service elsewhere. but are now devoting some of our life energies to, say, a local educational enterprise or a social service agency of one kind or another, whether as a full-time worker or part-time volunteer. One of Jennifer's lines from last Sunday's sermon rings true again here, and I think merits repeating. She said, "Even though they are not my relatives by blood, I'm grateful for Mennonite believers who made a witness in the Shenandoah Valley for peace, for education, for ethical business, for global and local mission, for family farms and quality craftsmanship, for church community and music, for welcoming refugees, for service to neighbors, for Jesus Christ. People like the Benders, people like us." I might add that in the big picture and the long run, for Joseph and Mary coming to Nazareth, whatever else they were doing, raising children was also at the heart of their vocation. After all, you never know what your child might grow up to become.
Thank you for listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, "Jesus, I Believe You're Near," composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.